From the Watson School of International and Public Affairs at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Dan Richards. In August 2022, just over 3 years ago, the Inflation Reduction Act was signed into law. It represented the largest federal investment in renewable energy and climate action in U.S. history. The bill was a historic victory for the U.S. climate movement. And, as it turns out, at least for the foreseeable future, the movement's high watermark. Since returning to office, President Trump has withdrawn the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement, rolled back numerous environmental and climate regulations, issued executive orders pausing renewable energy projects, and worked with Congress to dismantle key parts of the Inflation Reduction Act. So what does this new political landscape mean for the climate movement and for our planet? To explore these questions, I spoke with two experts on the politics and policy of climate change from the Watson School. Jeff Colgan is a professor of political science and director of Watson's Climate Solutions Lab. And Chris Ray is an assistant professor of sociology at Watson, whose research focuses on environmental and climate governance and politics. On this episode, we discuss the evolving politics of climate change in the United States, the state of the green transition in the U.S. and around the world, and where the climate movement goes from here. Jeff Colgan and Chris Ray, thank you both so much for coming on to Trending Globally.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having us, Dan.
Likewise. Yeah, pleasure to be here, Dan.
So our podcast is called Trending Globally, but I actually wanted to start with a more local story in our home state of Rhode Island that I think will maybe touch on some other issues we're going to talk more about. This summer, the Trump administration issued a stop work order on a nearly completed offshore wind power project off the coast of Rhode Island. It was something like 80% finished already. It was a multi-billion dollar project. And a judge has since allowed construction to resume, but the order is sort of winding its way through the courts. And I wonder what you both make of this. Like, what was the administration's official justification for halting this project? And do you buy that? And if not, sort of, what do you make of it?
Well, as I understand it, the nominal reason for the stop work order was national security, which is Trump's kind of go-to playing card for doing almost anything in terms of his executive orders. He's used that for the tariffs on Canada, Mexico, and a million other countries. He's used it for lots and lots of different moves that he's made. Obviously, the National Guard moves into various cities. So this is all driven by national security. And in part, that's because the way the federal government works, it gives the president enormous scope to take actions in the name of national security. Yet it is very hard to imagine the national security issue that underlies this stop work order.
Right. I was going to ask, is it that it was a foreign-owned company or that wind power is insecure in some way?
The lead construction company is Ørsted, which is a Danish company. But it is really hard to imagine that that's a serious, it's a NATO ally. This is not a national security concern. And yet it is clearly inconsistent with Trump's own ideological opposition to, I think, green tech broadly, but specifically wind energy. You know, he's been opposed to what he calls windmills, which of course are actually wind turbines, since something like the 1980s. He's objected to their ugliness and their bird-killing propensity, and he has sort of a set of other objections to the technology that are really not worth discussing because they're not well-grounded in fact.
Chris, what do you make of it?
Well, I would just pick up on what Jeff just said. You know, a simple explanation for the national security sort of justified stop work order is that he is sort of in the pocket of the fossil fuel industry and doing their bidding. But I actually think that that kind of explanation falls short. I think we have to think about the way that wind works in sort of cultural and symbolic terms for the Trump administration's opposition to wind specifically and renewable energy projects more generally. We have to think about both the ways that the fossil fuel industry has influenced the administration and its policies, but also the way that opposition to wind and renewable energy technology plays with the Republican Party base and the sort of electoral gains that are perceived to be got by opposing such technologies.
I definitely want to talk more about the sort of politics and the culture around climate change and what it all means for the climate movement. But I wonder if we could first look just a little bit more at some of the on-the-ground ways that the Trump administration has been shaping climate and environmental policy, you know, since Trump's second term has begun. What stands out to each of you as some of the most pressing ways that the Trump administration has changed climate and environmental policy?
Well, the undermining and revocation or clawing back, canceling of funding that was allocated to climate-related projects under the Inflation Reduction Act passed by the Biden administration is certainly the thing that jumps out to me as the most prominent and sort of wide-ranging Trump administration-led assault on renewable energy policy on the ground right now. I think we actually don't have a strong understanding of which particular projects in which places are actually targeted, which have been able to sort of preserve fundings in very concrete micro levels. But it's clear that renewable energy projects, solar, wind, and then also environmental justice-oriented projects have been targeted by the Trump administration. And we're talking about billions of dollars of funding that has been frozen or withdrawn. So with real consequences for communities, cities, states across the country.
I agree with Chris, and I think that that does stand out. But I would zoom out a little bit and just think about this. I'm an international relations scholar first and foremost, so I see not only the moves on foreign policy, like removing the U.S. once again from the Paris Agreement, but also, you know, the sharp contrast between what's happening in China and what's happening in the United States as a sort of easy shorthand to see the choice that the United States is currently making, right? So China is building solar energy in particular, but solar and wind at an extraordinary pace. I mean, it is building it faster than the whole rest of the world combined and really fundamentally changing their industrial base and kind of taking over at least a chunk of the industry of the future, because they have leapt forward in terms of the whole supply chain of electric vehicles, batteries, solar, wind. I mean, you name it, the green tech manufacturing, China is now dominating it. And the United States under Trump has pivoted back towards its traditional strength in fossil fuels and is busy trying to get other countries around the world, Japan, Europe, elsewhere, to buy American fossil fuels. And that, you know, divergence in kind of national strategy about how we think about powering our economies is to me as striking as Chris's point about the change inside the United States, where the Inflation Reduction Act is being fundamentally clawed back and undermined.
It makes sense to me if you are skeptical of the risks posed by climate change to be dismissive of things like solar power and wind power if it was more expensive compared to fossil fuel. And that was maybe a logic that people had earlier in the 21st century, say, but by many measures, wind and solar power are now cost competitive with types of fossil fuels. So why is the Trump administration seemingly trying to pull away from these technologies that it really seems like a lot of the rest of the world, as you said, including China, see as technologies of the future?
I think this is like one of the most important and puzzling questions about the political moment that we find ourselves in. So to Jeff's point about the divergence between, for example, China and the United States, business leaders in the United States are aware of this divergence and of the renewable energy economy of the future and the competitive dynamics with China, the incredible EV market, for example, that China is dominating now around the world and will continue to dominate while Detroit-based car manufacturers in the United States struggle to intervene into, and so on and so forth. So there are many economic reasons for large firms in the United States to push for and to embrace some form of the renewable energy transition. But clearly, the Trump administration is not pushing business and enterprise in that direction. And I think we can turn to sort of two big buckets of explanations. One is sort of short-term profits over longer-term trajectories, right? And then the other piece is sort of the electoral dynamics at work here, where renewable energy, for example, is coded in particular ways that are associated with liberalism, environmentalism, and so on and so on. These sorts of things that don't play well with the political constituency that supports the contemporary Republican, really the Trumpian Republican Party in the United States.
Yeah. So to Chris's point, I think we need to understand some of this kind of rejection of even the low cost, right, the commercially attractive renewable energy sources in cultural terms and in electoral terms, right? The Trump administration wants to build and take advantage of a base of voters that are very much opposed to renewable energy and reward supporters in the fossil fuel industry. Although it is worth saying, and I'll just add this as a little caveat, that it's striking to see leaders of major oil firms like Shell coming out in opposition to Trump's moves on offshore wind, right? So the stop work order against the Revolution project.
On what grounds?
Precisely because they say, look, life is long. Somebody else is going to have the White House in the future. And this kind of wild swings in regulatory permitting and in sort of creating business uncertainty is not good for anybody doing business. And so, sure, right now, it's great for fossil fuels. But, you know, the tide will turn. And we don't want to see the federal government taking these kinds of wild changes from administration to administration, because we know that eventually that'll hit us too. So it's kind of a really interesting public remark and kind of rebuke against the Trump administration on that specific point. And of course, there's lots of other things that the Trump administration is doing for fossil fuel industry that they love, including opening up the last pristine wilderness in the United States, or last large area of pristine wilderness, which is the Alaskan National Wildlife Refuge.
For drilling.
For drilling, yes.
I just want to add on to what Jeff said. I think a lot of social scientific research, not to say nothing of great journalism, has revealed the long-term efforts by, for example, fossil fuel industries to obfuscate truths about climate change, to delay action on climate change, and so on and so forth. So we shouldn't mince words about the role of that industry in slowing down our ability to address the problem of climate change. Something that Jeff said puts the sort of extreme and unusual nature of the Trump administration in perspective, which is that in this case, business is so concerned about the instability and the lack of future confidence about its ability to act and to be profitable and globally competitive in the future, that it is actually taking a stand in some cases like this in opposition to policies that would undermine climate politics. So another example of this that's currently sort of under discussion is the revocation of what's called the endangerment finding that was issued by the Environmental Protection Agency. The EPA issued this rule, which basically says that carbon dioxide is indeed a threat to human health and well-being vis-a-vis the effects of climate change, and therefore is eligible to be regulated under the Clean Air Act. This happened during the Obama administration, and now the Trump administration is trying to repeal this rule, right? On the grounds that it would remove inhibitions on industry, especially fossil fuel industries, to grow and be prosperous. But actually, many firms are very, very concerned about the removal of this rule, in part because they are able to currently argue in court that the EPA regulates greenhouse gas emissions and sets the rules for that. And if the rule were removed, states like, for example, California or Massachusetts or perhaps even Rhode Island could sue those companies and say, now that the EPA is no longer in charge, we can bring our lawsuits forward and sort of try to push these companies to take action on climate change, which then creates regulatory uncertainty and differentials across states. And in other words, a big regulatory mess for firms to try to navigate. So it is striking that the Trump administration's actions in the current political moment are so sort of extreme that even large corporations that have historically resisted efforts to address climate change are stepping back and saying, whoa, 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 let's tap the brakes. We're going too fast here.
That means because each state could then ostensibly set their own limits or their own guidelines and then sue these companies based on their own state laws.
In essence, correct. Yeah. In essence, correct. Yeah.
It's a great example, Chris, of just how extreme the Trump administration is. I mean, even compared to Trump, you know, first administration. Trump's second administration is just, you know, off the deep end in terms of its opposition to all things climate. And unfortunately, Chris and I have personal experience in this, in that we were co-PIs of a National Science Foundation grant to focus on clean energy and society, which was terminated by the Trump administration. Of course, lots of people were affected by it. Lots of researchers were affected by this kind of termination. But it is, you know, unfortunately, something that is very rare. I mean, I don't think it's in the NSF's history at all for a new presidential administration to come in and make that kind of termination of a grant that had already been awarded. This is just sort of something that wasn't done under the National Science Foundation. And so it's just one more example of just how far out on, I want to say the right wing, but maybe it's just sort of the extreme versions of governance the Trump administration, the second one, really is.
Right. It's a challenge that's not even necessarily so much about the ideology of given issues, but also just about process. We're seeing it all across the Trump administration. They'll try 50 different things and, you know, some of them will stick, some of them won't. And
exactly right, Dan. And some of them will not stick in the sense that they're labeled illegal, and yet somehow they stick in practice because there isn't sufficient institutional guardrails to prevent the Trump administration from doing what it wants to do. And that kind of gumming up the works of the federal government is something that, you know, Americans are, I think, only slowly awakening to how dramatic and how extreme the changes are to governance in the United States.
Going back to something we brought up at the very beginning of the conversation, while a lot of renewable energy, as we discussed, is increasingly sort of competitive cost-wise with fossil fuel production, fossil fuel is still a abundant source of domestic energy in the United States. And I wonder if, given that, does it make sense for Trump in some ways from a national security perspective to be doubling down on, I forget what the White House's claim of it was, but something like unleashing American energy. Is there a reason for that from this perspective of national security?
There's a couple of things that need to be said about that. One is that fossil fuel consumption is still being subsidized fairly heavily in this country. And so we are tilting the playing field in favor of fossil fuels. And so even if we were just to level it, I think there's a stronger case for, you know, adopting, you know, renewable energies. But then I think that the even more important point is thinking about not where the ball is, but where the ball's going. And the sort of the arc of the global economy is that very likely we are to see a global economy that is becoming more and more invested in these clean energy technologies because they're cost competitive and they're environmentally better and, you know, they solve local air pollution problems and, right? On and on and on. And so because this does appear to be kind of the wave of the future, yes, we can, in the short term, probably make a lot of bucks by doubling down on our sort of old strategy, but it means we're mortgaging our future, right? It means that we are going to lose out on markets around the world into the future. And so this is the real trade-off. And unfortunately, politically, this is a really difficult thing to show because in the meantime, you know, the story is going to be, look, we're making lots of money and look, the stock market is going up. And so why not take advantage of that narrative? And so I don't really have a solution to that problem, but I think it's a real, you know, long-term versus short-term thinking issue.
I guess I would just add two quick points. One is that diversity is helpful in the sense of resilience. So a diversified energy portfolio, if you want, is more likely, in my view, to be able to promote security in an abstract sense, right? If you're not relying on a particular technology, but a suite of technologies, many of, or all of which could be renewable, then we're probably in a more secure position. We can also think about security more broadly and about the way, what makes a population secure, what minimizes conflict. And without getting into all of the details, a highly sort of unstable climate system layered on top of a highly unequal society is not a recipe for stability and security, right? So addressing climate change is probably one of the best long-term things we can do to promote security in a broader sense. to say, you know, setting aside the narrower definition of sort of just like conflict between nations or something like this.
As the federal government challenges climate action and steps away from climate action, are there ways that you see states, cities, or civil society potentially filling any gaps when it comes to addressing climate change and environmental protections? Or is it just something that really can only be done meaningfully at a federal level?
Well, I do think that, you know, the federal government has played a historically important role in addressing environmental problems. A deference to the states in this way has not historically played out particularly well and has usually resulted in, at best, a piecemeal, sort of very fragmented regulatory structure. And therefore, the federal government's role plays the same sort of moderating role that we were discussing before in terms of business, right? So it's critical. That being said, states, particularly ones whose politics are amenable to taking action on climate change, can and are, I think, taking action to help us move forward. I'll just note that this is not unprecedented in any way. During the first Trump administration, states also took the lead. If I'm not mistaken, Gavin Newsom, then and still governor of California, actually traveled to China to sort of mediate diplomatic relations with that country around the topic of climate change. And there have been similar sorts of efforts. Now, that being said, my sense is that states are reeling. We're talking about contexts where tens of billions, perhaps hundreds of billions of dollars for the largest states are being frozen or withdrawn, that funded programs that states depended upon. And this is not exclusive to climate, but it certainly includes climate.
So these were like investments in solar production, battery production, that's the type of investment that you're saying is now being sending them reeling.
Yes, that sort of thing. But also, for example, again, through the Inflation Reduction Act, right, large grant, state block grants that were given to, for example, help cities and communities address problems of energy efficiency. So mundane things like insulating homes, replacing windows, putting insulation in and things like this. So that sort of stuff. But also much more fundamental things, right? Like even at the federal level right now, during the government shutdown, we're looking at the inability to fund food stamps for people who don't have enough money to pay for their basic necessities. And those same sorts of programs administered at state levels are sort of reeling across the board, I think.
So I would add a couple of things where actually I think there is some hope and opportunity for individuals to get involved in climate politics at a local level. But I want to just underline two things that Chris said, because one, there's no substitute for the federal government on the problem of climate change. There just isn't. And so unfortunately, we really need to have a federal government that recognizes the problem and wants to act on it. And two, that state governments are being just overwhelmed, you know, so busy playing defense against all of the various changes on, you know, Medicaid and SNAP and all the other policies, that the idea of making progress on climate change is just not very high on the agenda, because there's just so many other things to deal with. But that being said, I think there's two ways that individuals actually can probably have their most impact on, you know, climate change or future green energy policies are at the local level. One, since the Biden administration got into power and really visibly embraced clean energy and wanted to sort of accelerate clean energy, what we've seen in this country is a real backlash at the local level. So something like a fifth of all counties, all 3,000 counties in the United States, now have some kind of restrictive ordinance against wind or solar energy, so that they can't be built in their counties, right? Sometimes it's an outright ban. Sometimes it's kind of setback requirements or various types of restrictions. Often it is so restrictive that there's just no way to build. And so one thing that individuals can do is get on the other side of that and say, you know, let's not be a NIMBY county. Let's be a YIMBY, something like that, a building here and encouraging green energy to be built in your own community. And the second thing that's important is paying attention to things that were previously arcane, like public utility commissions, which are the people who set the price of your electricity at home. Those elections of getting the commissioners who would set the policy of, you know, what kind of electricity is going to be built in your state and how much it's going to be built and how fast it's going to be built. These things used to be the kind of thing that would be like, okay, well, you know, we don't have to worry about that too much. But now we do, because the Trump administration is making it so difficult to build electricity and particularly green electricity. And so that's another thing that individuals can do in their local communities that might make us not only feel like we're contributing, but actually contribute to the problem of climate change in ways that the federal government right now feels, you know, kind of distant and a little bit hopeless, at least for until the next election cycle.
Well, you know, climate change is, of course, a global problem. And we've already touched on some of the international dynamics at play. And as the U.S. under the Trump administration really continues to pull back any sort of leadership role in a global climate type effort, how has that changed the global effort? Are other countries or other groups of countries effectively taking the lead?
I think this is such an important question because on the one hand, the Trump administration's moves towards fossil fuel and away from anything looking like climate action really, you know, sets the mood globally around, you know, how much ambition countries feel like they can have or even would want to have. And so it certainly lowered the global ambition in that sense. And then it's got some real policy consequences. So, for instance, there is something called the International Maritime Organization that sets the rules for global shipping. And it was an organization that was inching slowly, slowly towards having a real meaningful carbon tax to try to shift patterns of fuel consumption by ocean-going ships significantly. This is sounds, again, maybe remote from your everyday life, but if we could cut that in half, that is a big win in climate terms because we're always looking for those chunks. And unfortunately, the Trump administration led a coalition of petrostates, of oil exporting states, to block that change at the IMO, a change that was, you know, looked like it was going to happen, got killed because of U.S. opposition.
Chris?
Yeah, I'll just go back a little bit on our conversation to add that China, which both is at the forefront of the renewable energy transition, as Jeff articulated earlier, and also is the world's not only leading emitter of carbon dioxide, but consumer of and producer of coal. But nonetheless, China is at the forefront of the renewable energy transition. And I have to return to sort of the paradoxical nature of the current moment that we're in, which is to say that the U.S. is not particularly sort of right-wing, hawkish type politicians are not often in the business of willingly ceding ground to their most visible and dominant geopolitical rival. But in this case, that's precisely what we're seeing. And so I think this is an intriguing problem. It has real policy consequences, and we have a lot to think about to figure out why exactly it's playing out the way that it is.
It's such a great point, Chris. And I mean, I would just emphasize too that yes, right now oil and gas are pretty profitable. And as Dan, you pointed out that solar and wind have become much more cost competitive. But in terms of profits, the fossil fuel industry is very hard to beat at the moment. But China has proven over the last 25 years that you can position yourself as a leader of the clean energy space and make a whole lot of money doing it and also start to eat into the market share. And when we think about how countries have gotten rich over time, particularly in the 20th century, the car industry was always a really big part of that, right? So the United States was first into getting GM and Ford. And there was a time when like the success of the country was seen as intimately linked to GM and Ford. And then other countries in Europe and elsewhere started building cars as another, you know, way of industrializing and developing their economy. Japan comes and does it in the 70s. Korea's done it as well. Now we are in a position where China is building cheaper, better electric vehicles and beginning to own that global market in a way that the West cannot compete with, right? We are not at a point where we can compete with. And this is Chris's point, where we are ceding ground to our geopolitical rival, right? Because we are failing to invest in the manufacturing capability of the next wave of cars, which are these electric vehicles. And not only do I expect China to, you know, further develop partly on the back of its car industry, but also one has to worry about really undermining what has traditionally been a major export for the United States and its allies. Suddenly, it's China that's going to be owning that space. And you can really see it in Africa, where I'll move away from cars for a moment, but solar and wind, in the last 6 months even, the solar consumption in Africa has gone through the roof because the economics of it are just so great. And so that's a sort of a canary in the coal mine moment to me, to recognize the potential of the Global South as a market and how China is taking advantage of that opportunity in ways that the U.S., unfortunately, because of Trump's leadership, we are just not doing that.
And once again, this type of seeding the ground, do you both see largely as coming from a more short-term political expediency? If it doesn't seem to make sense geopolitically in your eyes, and it doesn't seem to make a ton of sense economically, it's more about the next election or maybe the one after that.
I mean, I think Jeff is our resident political scientist in the room right now, although maybe not an Americanist per se, but I would have to agree, if only by my inability to develop a more compelling explanation. I guess I would just add one other piece that Jeff touched on the profitability issue, which is that there is an argument out there that despite the declining costs of renewable energy, the profitability of renewable energy remains substantially below fossil fuels. That is, you can make a lot more money, even if it also costs more to produce and sell, by producing fossil fuels than you can by producing and selling renewable energy. So that could also be an important piece of the puzzle, but it's not obvious that that is a sort of a long-term explanation, in the sense that, as Jeff said, China is, for example, already dominating and will continue for the foreseeable future to dominate the, for example, EV market, the electric vehicle market in Latin America and in Africa, in a way that Detroit is just completely losing out on.
Dan, I mean, you asked us what's going on here, what's the thinking? And I do think that for the Trump administration, it's all politics first and economics second. And this is not just on climate, but on, you know, a whole set of issues. And so the willingness to do real harm to the U.S. economy in exchange for, you know, political benefits for Trump is something that he's willing to do, you know, nine times out of 10.
Just the other day, the Secretary General of the U.N., said in an interview that humanity has, quote, failed to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius, which was the international goal set by the Paris Agreement. Have we really missed the target on that? And if so, how should people who care about climate think about success or meaningful goals for the future? And if we haven't failed, is there a way back?
My understanding of this, the 1.5 degree Celsius target, is that it is formally speaking attainable. But in practice, the odds of this happening are vanishingly small, and that we're probably headed to a world of, 2.5 to 3.5 degrees of warming, sort of in a moderately okay scenario based on the trajectory that we're on. So that is to say that we already live in a climate changed world, and we will continue to live in a more severely climate changed world as we move forward in time. So that does not negate, in my view, in any way, the need to take as rapid and as dramatic action as we can to address the problems of climate change, which includes everything from sort of consumptive actions of, you know, like if you're able to, moving to an electric vehicle or something like that, to getting involved with your local planning board or public utility commission, as Jeff talked about before, to sort of fight those fights in whatever capacity you're able to do it. But it also means thinking about the way that the world will be reordered and restructured given the changes that we are going to endure. And so thinking about the distributional effects, that is to say, who is going to sort of win out and who is going to face tremendous challenges as a result of these changes, being proactive about thinking about solutions to those things, questions of insurance, of livability along coastlines and in areas prone to fire and things like this are front and center.
Two things that I think are helpful in thinking about this. One is that temperature increases have nonlinear effects. So every additional tenth of a degree is going to be worse than the previous tenth of a degree that we went up. It will get worse and worse.
In terms of its effects on
the planet as a whole, on, you know, feedback, setting off feedback cycles, triggers like Arctic ice sheets melting, et cetera. And so it gets worse in that sense. But also the analogy to the human body, right? So that when we have a fever, and if we have a 2-degree fever, probably, you know, you might be feeling crummy, but you're okay. If you have a, you know, 6-degree fever, you're going to the hospital, especially if it's 6 degrees Celsius, you're going to the hospital. And so understanding that there's, you know, whenever we talk in climate change terms of like, you know, a few tenths of a degree, it sounds pretty trivial unless you're familiar with the science. The way to think about that is to think about it in terms of your own, like the planet has a fever and each, you know, notch we take up gets worse and worse. And so there is no, you know, bright red line of success or failure on climate change, that we're probably going to exceed 2 degrees Celsius by the century's end. But it matters a lot whether it's 2.5 degrees or 3.5 degrees, because the difference between those worlds is pretty catastrophic, particularly for hundreds of millions of people in the global south. And this is also going to matter for Florida and South Carolina and a whole lot of other places, and including here in Rhode Island, that we're going to have more heat waves. Like, we're all going to feel some of this, but it's going to be even more catastrophic if you happen to live, say, in low-lying Bangladesh and the sea is eroding your country.
Do you both feel like the climate movement has lost momentum in the last, say, decade or 15 years?
Well, I mean, it's very easy, you know, sitting here in the lofty ivory tower of Brown University, it's easy to be critical of the climate movement and suggest that it's lost momentum, which I think it has, if only because of the extreme defensive position that it finds itself within. So I would rather focus on all of the incredible work the climate movement has done, right? Which is, for example, to set the stage for the Inflation Reduction Act to be passed, for that money to be allocated, and so on, in the U.S. context. And globally, there are other examples of this. So, for example, the 1.5 degree target that we were just talking about as the Paris Agreement in 2015 was pushed forward and inserted into that agreement in part by the advocacy of many small nations, particularly small island nations, that had a tremendous impact on those negotiations. The unfortunate part of this, all though, is that there has been tremendous backlash. So a major question is not so much, you know, is the climate movement, has it lost steam or something like that, but rather how can it think past and beyond the reactionary politics that it's currently fighting against? And I'm not sure if I know answers to that, but I think that's a really important question for us to think about.
I think the climate movement has actually gotten stronger over 15 years. If you go back to 2010, that was pre-Paris, the Kyoto Protocol was failing, right? So that there was really no governance mechanism. And this was pre sort of Greta Thunberg and a whole lot of other actors who have made climate change, you know, move up on the political agendas. Now, that's not to say that we've solved the problem. In fact, if anything, the problem has gotten worse in those 15 years. So the politics and the sort of the movement to try to address the problem has gotten stronger. But the thing about all politics, and especially climate politics, is that there's going to be highs and lows. We had, I think, a real high movement in the Biden administration for the climate movement. And I think it was easy for people who were inside the climate movement to think, aha, we're now on a different trajectory and that trajectory is going to continue upwards. We're going to make more and more progress on climate change. And that's not the way the world worked out. And I expect that that's what we'll see in the future, is that there'll be, you know, a pendulum swing back and forth, understanding that just because you're having a setback today doesn't mean that you give up and you go home.
One little tidbit that I'd like to just plug in relation to this that I think it's worth thinking about is that the movement has spent a lot of time with a theory of change in mind that is sort of educational, which is to say that if we can get people to understand climate change well, they will act on climate change. And I am just not particularly compelled by that way of thinking and that theory of change. I'm actually much more compelled by the ways that movements can push for specific policy changes that then people experience and develop new politics in relation to, like realizing like, hey, actually the solar panels on my house are really cool, or, you know, whatever it may be in a particular context, right? And hammering the like, let's just get people to understand climate change is a relatively small piece of the puzzle.
Great points, Chris. And can I just add, like, the idea of creating alternative attractive behaviors, right? So driving an electric vehicle instead of driving an internal combustion engine, the more that we can A, develop technology to make that easy, and then B, help the politics of technological change, right? So what we know from history is that just because there's a new product doesn't mean that it instantly gets adopted by society. And so I'm completely with Chris on this, that that's where we can have a lot of effect beyond just, you know, trying to scare people with by reciting the facts of what will come if we don't act on climate change.
We keep talking about these technologies that are also stratified heavily by income, right? So there's also equity concerns that we haven't touched on a lot. The ability for people to access quote unquote climate solutions, EVs, solar energy, whatever it may be, to relocate if their home is in a place that where it's going to be threatened by rising sea levels and hurricanes or wildfires or things like this. Those things are all just conditioned on people's economic means. Those are just also important pieces of the puzzle that we have to think through and attend to.
It makes me think of that phrase, I forget who said it, but that, you know, the future's here, it's just unevenly distributed.
Yeah, and I think I would add to that, it's unevenly distributed in part because of politics, right? That China is making an electric vehicle that costs $15,000 and it's better than most of the cars in the U.S. Market. And so Chris is totally right to point out that in the current U.S. market, you know, electric vehicles are kind of luxury vehicles. They're high-end vehicles. But it doesn't have to be that way. We are making incredibly stupid choices on this, and we could do better. And so that unevenness of the future is in part up to, you know, wise political leadership. And, you know, that's in short supply in this country.
One last question I want to wrap up with, continuing to sort of look ahead. In this space where so many of these climate solutions are polarized or are really unevenly accessible to individuals as consumption choices, do you see there being reason for more advocacy or research into other types of mitigation of climate change, things like carbon capture or geoengineering, things that, you know, maybe once were considered not incredibly welcome within the climate movement to be emphasizing now as we're blowing past 1.5 degrees and encountering all sorts of trouble domestically? Do you think there should be more research into those types of things, or how do you think about them?
I mean, I see geoengineering as a very complex issue that reasonable people can disagree about, because I know some very smart people who are very much in favor of it as, unfortunately, the kind of situation that we're going to have to embrace. I personally am not persuaded by that. I think that it creates more risks than it solves, at least at the moment. I would add just one other thing about carbon capture and storage. And I'm sorry, Chris, I'll turn this over to you. Maybe I should leave this topic for you. But so far, at least, carbon capture and storage has proven to be something of an expensive subsidy for the fossil fuel industry, in that it's the solution that they always want to promote, that they benefit from. They've received a lot of money, billions of dollars from the federal government in this country and in other countries to show that it can work. And right now, it's not actually great at withdrawing carbon dioxide from the air. And so until we have more proof that that's actually a viable technology, I'm going to maintain my skepticism around it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree about the carbon capture point. And I'm not an engineer, so my objections are around sort of the implementation and the realization of the technology, not its, you know, technical capacity into the future. One thing that I think that is sort of especially, I'm reluctant to say dangerous, but for lack of a better word, dangerous about carbon capture is that it has the sort of same aura as nuclear fusion. In the sense that it's, you know, like this magic bullet that could solve all of our climate problems. But the thing that makes it more dangerous than that is that it is actually a technology that is close enough to implementable that a lot of money is being poured into it and a lot of political capital being pushed towards it in a way that I think is not actually helping us move forward on climate in a serious way. Whereas at least nuclear fusion is, you know, sort of like far enough in the distance that it remains sort of pie in the sky and not a prominent piece of the current policy debate.
Well, speaking of nuclear energy, if not nuclear fusion, which is a more sort of theoretical technology at this point, but nuclear energy as it exists today is another interesting example of the shifting politics around climate change and thinking about climate solutions. Do you see a place for nuclear energy, more traditional nuclear energy in the climate and environmental movement going forward?
in the environmental movement and specifically the climate movement, we've seen a real embrace of that technology, at least within segments of the movement, in a way that wasn't true 20 years ago or 30 years ago, certainly. You know, if we set aside the thorny problems of danger and waste that are associated with that technology, from a climate perspective, it offers lots of promise. And so I remain, I guess, ambivalent about it, but it has certainly changed its position in the broader sort of space of environmental politics, given the climate crisis.
It does sound, as you both are describing it, like despite this moment of seemingly defensiveness or retreat for a lot of climate activists, it's also a moment of a lot of rethinking and flexibility about kind of the next step in this path. And like you said, climate change is not going away. It doesn't operate on the scale of one or two presidential elections. And this is maybe being taken as a moment to sort of step back and rethink what addressing climate change looks like.
I think that's right. And we are seeing some rethinking, you know, sort of across the spectrum, right? So, you know, right, centrist and left about it, because the super viable approach that is just lurking out there hasn't been identified yet. And the problems that we're experiencing with climate change are going to grow more visible in our everyday lives in terms of climate affecting our health, our home insurance, our electrical prices, and on and on and on. And so that kind of thing is the incentive ultimately to address the problem.
And to link back to politics, there's at least some evidence, for example, in social movement scholarship on the effects of experiences of environmental harms as a mobilizing force for people. So we can't rely on this as like, you know, once people experience climate, action will follow. This is an extremely simple model that is absolutely not true. But it's also the case that if we nest those experiences in sort of an ecology of climate-oriented activism and politics that helps people sort of actualize those their experiences into political action or transform their experiences in political action, then we might be able to translate some of the difficulties that people face into political actions that help address those problems. That would be the hope, but that requires a very robust movement and probably a supportive political infrastructure to go along with it to take action. And we're not in that moment right now.
Well, Chris, Jeff, thank you both so much for helping us kind of take stock of where this issue stands in American politics and in the world today, and help us think about, you know, where it might go from here.
Thanks for having us on, Dan. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dan. It's been fun.
This episode was produced by me, Dan Richards, with production assistance from Errol Danahy. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield, with additional music from the Blue Dot Sessions. If you like this show, leave us a rating and review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps others to find us. And if you haven't subscribed to Trending Globally, please do that too. If you have any questions or comments or ideas for guests or topics for the show, send us an email at trendingglobally@brown.edu. Again, that's all one word, trendingglobally@brown.edu. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Trending Globally. Thanks.